Good morning. It is Friday, November 3rd. You're listening to the MacroCast. I'm your guest host today, Brian DeAngelis, back after a long hiatus to fill in for Alon. And hopefully we'll help you all appreciate Alon's expertise even more. But I'll do my best to fill in this week. And always happy to be back with my friends, John and Brendan. We've got a busy week this week that we've jumped into. The jobs numbers just came out. Powell had his press conference earlier this week after the Fed meetings. John, Brendan, I kind of wanted to start there. So the Fed held steady. You know, lot of talk of kind of just kind of staying where we are right now. Powell is not really giving much indication of what's to come next, but seems committed to kind of holding firm and not giving up at least the option to maybe raise again if he has to. But what did you take from this week's meetings and some of his comments?
Yeah, it thanks, Brian. And it's always great to have you hosting the show. So welcome back.
Thank you.
Yeah, this was going to be kind of a potentially wacky Wednesday for the Treasury market. We were going into the Fed meeting where there were still some residual, you know, questions about whether the Fed would be signaling another rate hike coming, even if they stayed on hold at this particular meeting. And this was also the same day that the Treasury Department came out with its refunding announcement and how much it would be issuing in various maturities in the Treasury market. And so there was some trepidation going into it. We've obviously seen a lot of volatility, pronounced volatility in the Treasury market at a in the longer end discussion about, you know, what is really driving it. You know, how can this be happening to the Treasury market when the world is looking so much riskier? And this is supposed to be the safe haven trade. Well, we go into Wednesday, and the Treasury's refunding announcement ends up being, you know, relatively tamer, more judicious in terms of the placement of the, you know, the volume of issuance away from the back end, the longer duration Treasuries that have been suffering sort of the brunt of this latest sell-off, and that kind of calmed things down, and the Federal Reserve. It seemed as though Chair Powell was in kind of, you know, Hippocratic oath mode, you know, like harm.
Yes.
He tried to, you know, keep steady messaging. And I think in general, that's the case. But markets were always going to seize on particular aspects. And the fact, I think, you know, that he in his remarks downplayed the significance of the September dot plot, which had been showing, you know, the expectations. You know, the central set of expectations showing another rate hike in this cycle. You know, his downplaying of that, I think, was taken as a dovish signal. And that had, you know, another rate hike had been largely priced out. The sense, you know, now is that Powell is in, you know, now the markets, now that essentially the expectation is that rates have leveled off, now markets are in like full, you know, when's the next cut? When's the cut?
Right.
When are the cuts coming mode?
But John, do you think, Powell clearly said, you know, we're data dependent. Do you think that is why the Treasury market's so volatile? Like last week, you could have bought a 10-year Treasury that yielded 5%. Now it's yielding 5.5%. Like that kind of volatility is like a, you know, like a penny stock. That's pretty crazy stuff.
Yeah, it is. It has not been a comfortable month for the Treasury market. No question about it. Yeah, is the Fed's sort of meeting by meeting, you know, uncertainty part of the factor, and you know the idea that they're going to hold higher for longer. I certainly think so, and I definitely agree with that. But in some ways, you know, and we've talked about this kind of thing before. The volatility in the Treasury market and the uplift in longer dated Treasury yields is a feature, not a bug. Like this is kind of what the Fed has been trying to do, right? They don't want it to go too fast. They don't want it to go overboard. And so you see, you know, in the remarks that Powell made, maybe a little bit of a tilt back toward caution in the face. And he alluded to it, you know, the fact that these rates have come up a lot and they've tightened financial conditions by doing so. And so I think that, you know, the Fed is going to be you know, on the gas and the brakes in terms of their communication. They obviously don't want this idea of, you know, the Fed is about to cut, you know, to right. start getting traction. And when you look at futures yeah. markets, it's creeping forward again. You know, the odds of a cut by May are now like pretty significant. And that is a pretty fast pirouette. But Powell has shown himself in the past to make, you know, relatively abrupt shifts in policy posture and direction. So, you know, maybe markets are just, you know, learning from experience, I guess.
Yeah, he seemed pretty guarded on this point. I saw someone on CNBC describe him as the, you know, stern dad telling the kids in the back seat, don't make me pull over this car, right? Like he wants markets to react accordingly and not get too excited, and is sort of positioning that with some of his remarks. And I think that's smart. I'm curious, well, you guys, there's still a lot of economic headwinds out there. I mean, between some of the global uncertainty, I'm sitting in DC, we're 15 days away from probably a government shutdown, and we've got a speaker that's barely 2 weeks on the job. Who knows how this will be handled and how long this will be? Energy prices. I mean, there's still a lot out there that could throw things into flux.
Yeah, and that's what John and I have been saying. So you brought up some exogenous factors, but just the simple factor of the Fed raising rates so quickly in 2023, that takes a while to feed through
yeah.
the overall economy. And not that we're thinking it's the end of the world, but that things are going to slow down in 2024. We think it's kind of a mild recession, you know, where growth just kind of stalls. But very simply, and also just from a psychological perspective, you have a bunch of people that run businesses that have never really had to run a business with rates this high. You always right. could refinance at a lower rate, you know, so business models kind of have to change, whether you're, you know, thinking about opening up another pizza shop or whether you're the CFO of Microsoft. All of this changes because now you can just park your money in the treasury market and get a good yield. But more importantly, if you want to expand your business, instead of borrowing at 3%, 4%, or 5%, now you're at 10, 12, 15%, depending how risky your business is. That's just going to slow the economy. Where that hits the consumer first. So we saw the mortgage market rates went up, and immediately the housing market slowed. You know, Harley Davidson just reported, and their sales were weak because it's that much more expensive to buy a, you know, discretionary item like a Harley. It takes businesses longer to for that to feed through because, you know, they're able to borrow at longer rates and they make larger decisions. So we think that's where 2024 is going to really start to slow the business economy. But also, as you said, the consumer has a lot of headwinds. They have to start paying off their student debt. Rates are that much higher. We're probably going to shut down again. Right. And then with the geopolitical situations, oil prices are, you know, they've come off from their highs, gas prices, but, you know, it's still, you know, $3.50, $4 to fill up your tank. So per gallon. So those are just headwinds that we didn't have in the previous couple of years. Not that it has to be the end of the world, but, you know, things are definitely going to not be quite as rosy as they were in 2023.
Yeah. And last time I was on and we talked, and obviously I've been a loyal listener, even in my absence, you guys were predicting kind of a relatively short and mild, but definitely a recession kind of end of this year, early kind of 2024. Is that still what you're looking at? Or is that, we've seen some of the banks and others kind of push that further and further out into the horizon. But what are you guys seeing in terms of, you know, where the recession and maybe when we start getting into a cut environment?
In terms of growth, like I said, we expect 2024 to slow down, where, you know, we've been growing at above trend growth. I think trend growth is that 2-3%, but I think we'll see below it. Whether it's an actual recession and we grow negatively, I think that's, you know, not sort of the point, but we're going to slow down to kind of stall rate. The market is now pricing in cuts in the back half. I'll let John speak to where we see that going.
Yeah, that really is the disconnect that we see coming next year, that as, you know, economic data slows, the market is going to reflexively start pulling forward those rate cut expectations. And we think that the Fed is going to be, you know, tested again in their communications, they're going to have to, you know, inform the market that no, in fact, higher for longer really does mean even in the face of some economic softness. And we think that that's really going to be driven by the sticky inflation and the concerns that the Fed is going to have about declaring victory too soon. That is, we think, the balance of risks that they're facing. We think that the Fed's mindset is that the worst among them would be to prematurely cut rates and get an inflation echo coming back through the market and through the economy, rather than, you know, engineering a mild recession, perhaps. And so we do expect the Fed to withstand the pressure from the markets and deliver. None of the rate cuts that we see that are, you know, beginning to be priced in the spring and summer. We think that the Fed really holds the line.
John, say more about that inflation echo. What does that look like if that were to happen?
Yeah, it really is, you know, that model from the 70s where you saw, like, if you go back and look at it, it's like the three peaks of inflation. And so we've talked a little bit about this before. You know, the sort of modern mindset of monetary policymakers is that Volcker doesn't necessarily tell you, the lesson from Volcker doesn't necessarily tell you how tight your, you know, policy has to be, how tight financial conditions have to be. Right. The lesson from Volcker is more pointedly, don't cut too soon. Yeah. It's, you know, the length of time that you are at a restrictive level is important for wringing out those, you know, residual inflationary dynamics. And, you know, you can see in the current dynamic, as Brendan alluded to before, energy prices are persistently high. And although those get stripped out of the core, you know, everybody knows that they feed into a lot of other prices that are, you know, that are in the core, because they're just so fundamental and part of the interwoven, you know, almost all the business activity you can think of. So anyway, it's the reality is, you know, we think the Fed is going to have to, you know, continue to hammer home this higher for longer. And that messaging is going to be challenged by, you know, softening economic conditions like we saw in this morning's non-farm payrolls number, not falling off the table by any stretch of the imagination, but incremental weakness.
Yeah, we're hot off the presses. We've got the jobs report, and we are seeing, you know, some of Powell's strategy kind of bleed into this, I think, where it's, as John said, not falling off a cliff, but we seem to be starting to level out on both jobs and wages.
Yeah, so this jobs report, I think, is very indicative of what the Fed is trying to do. We saw a large slowdown in job gains. It was 150,000, but you do have to add 30,000 back for the UAW strike. So just keep that in mind, because we luckily did end that. So they'll come back to work. But when you look at the details of the employment in the terms of the establishment survey, it's following a trend of the last couple of months where the jobs that kind of held steady during the COVID and actually added, those have really been slowing. And the jobs that people didn't do and were hard to fill post-COVID are starting to fill back. So private education and health services, again, had a strong month and added basically a third to the private job gains. And also leisure and hospitality, you know, those are ones.
Even construction I'm seeing here.
Yep.
Construction
also added 25. But in like retail trade lost 5,600 jobs. And this is ramping up into, you know, holiday spending, which is usually when you see job gains. So the job market is definitely slowing. So there's two surveys, the establishment survey where you send, you know, surveys out to actual companies and they send it back. And then the unemployment rate, that's a survey that goes out to households. So in that, we both saw the civilian labor force drop by 201,000, which is a sign that the economy is slowing, but also the number employed dropped by 348,000. So the household survey showing people actually losing jobs. That's why the unemployment rate went up to 5.9%. Now, I always find there's two kind of good forward-looking indicators within these jobs report. One is the revisions, and there was almost 150,000 downward revisions. So last month wasn't quite as rosy. It was below 300,000. But also they have job losers and people who completed temporary jobs, and then job leavers. So when the economy is doing really well, people don't lose their jobs, and people leave their jobs to get a better job. So right. The job losers went up 200,000, and the job leavers were only 3,000. So people are definitely less confident in you know, finding another job, and they're going to kind of buckle down. So this jobs report is kind of a bit of Goldilocks. And also, more importantly, the wage gains were only 0.2%. So kind of back to, you know, where we were pre-COVID without the huge gains. Though it's clear that working for a union definitely still work in America. So that'll go up in the next couple of months with the auto workers. But it's the tough balance for the Fed. The employment situation is definitely slowing. You want it to slow, but you don't want to kill it. So we'll see how that goes going forward.
Yeah, I don't want to put too much attention on any one piece, but you mentioned retail, and we were talking earlier about, you know, consumers kind of feeling this first. I mean, is this further evidence that consumers are finally feeling the squeeze? I mean, they've been a little bit of a, you know, opposite reaction to what we wanted, where they've stayed hot through a lot of this cycle, but are they finally starting to slow down, or do we think this is just temporary and we'll have another gangbusters holiday season?
So luckily, we also have been having earnings season. So we've had a lot of commentary from, you know, various companies. And definitely the overarching theme is that the consumer definitely is slowing, whether it's, you know, Target in the retail or airlines. And as I alluded to earlier, Harley-Davidson huge decrease. Harley's actually helping lower your rate, so they're paying part of your loan to bring down that loan rate. The same with home builders; will buy back part of your mortgage to help inspire you to buy a house
to keep going.
So
yeah,
equally, the tone was not falling off a cliff, but definitely people have bought a lot, and the holiday season is going to be kind of steady rather than accelerating. And then after that, they're not necessarily worried that the end of the world, but pulling back. Actually, Apple reported last night, and for the first time ever, they had consecutive quarters of slowing sales. That's never happened in Apple's history, basically.
Guided for a pretty glum holiday season relative to expectations. So, and they pointed to China as well as a big threat. Estee Lauder was another company that announced this week that really rang the bell on, the warning bell on Chinese consumers. And that stock took a beating after that. And this is, you know, even as the government in Beijing has been trying to incentivize more spending, even after pulling off the COVID zero earlier this year, and those hopes for a big rebound have really fallen flat.
And John, so, I think that's a really important point you make, because I know we so much focus on China as an export country, but now they're a huge driver of high-end purchases, you know, whether it's goods or also the gambling sector. So it'll be interesting when the casinos report. And I feel like it's part of an underreported story here in America. We're so focused on ourselves. But, you know, all of our big companies are global companies, and they very much rely on the Chinese consumer.
Well, speaking of kind of focused on ourselves, allow me the political question. If you're Biden, you know, you've got some big domestic pressures to be tough on China and to do the, you know, the sort of small yard, high fence approach that they've been following. But you've got to open up this market a little bit if you want the economy to kind of bounce back as well heading into an election year. How do you guys see him or really Treasury and Yellen kind of juggling those two challenges?
Yeah, I think that the cost benefit analysis of getting, you know, some concessions to China, maybe in order to, you know, give the economy a boost or the markets a boost ahead of the election, opens you up, you know, to a pretty serious broadside of criticism.
Right.
And so I think that with the bipartisan posture in this town that you well know that, there's a very unified spirit in terms of, treating China as a strategic competitor / adversary rather than a source of economic growth, which it had really been characterized as predominantly for years in D.C. So I think that, there are easier ways to do it. I think if the Biden administration is interested in some sort of, a little bit of give and take with the Chinese leadership, then probably the second term would be the better venue for that kind of warming up or cattle trading or whatever it is. But the current way that China is operating in a geostrategic way is not enticing necessarily in D.C. to extend the olive branch. So. The sense is that they're probably made their bed, the Biden administration, as it comes to the economy. There's just not that much they can do between now and the election. Having the infrastructure and the Inflation Reduction Act spending hit, continue to flow into projects into the economy is something that they will surely be hanging their hat on and will be touting in the election year. But is there anything else that they can do really organically? It's pretty hard to say, especially with the kind of lags that you can expect with economic policies.
Yeah, and I tend to completely agree on China, especially if you think about Biden's brand and the geopolitical challenges in the world. I mean, he's going to have to kind of be the adult in the room, both on the kind of world stage as he runs for re-election, but he can't really give up much of his flank either on China domestically. But the other point is he's got a pretty tough slog ahead of him with Congress. I think we are 15 days away from a shutdown. How much is the market kind of pricing this in? Are they optimistic we'll get another CR that punts us to January or whatever Johnson wants to do? What are you guys seeing in terms of those signals?
Let us throw that back to you.
I think there's no chance we don't shut down. Yeah. but I think
it's somewhat unprecedented, with this little experience to make his way into the speakership, and also someone that is definitely on the far right of the party.
But punting it into the new year, Brian, just getting us through the holiday season, don't you think he has like enough support, no matter how radical you are, a holiday season shutdown maybe isn't good for anybody. So it depends
how he does it. He's thrown out some pretty wacky ideas so far. I mean, the latest being what they're calling a laddered CR, where they would literally go department by department, which I have no idea how that would work in reality. But what's so different, and I think because he's so new to this, is, I mean, forget about the Democrats. He's just not even close to being aligned with his Senate Republicans, even some of the mainstream part of his members. So he's really on an island, as you're seeing kind of McConnell, Schumer, and Biden almost lock arms on what they want to do with Israel, with Ukraine, even Taiwan, that, I think we're going to be in another situation where Johnson's going to have to blink. And right now, blinking in the House means he might be one of the shortest speakers in history.
Yeah, because the interesting part about McCarthy, well, publicly, he would say some things, but privately, he just kind of wanted to get the deals done.
He knew how to work the system. Yeah. And he knew kind of like, I don't think he was the greatest speaker, but, he knew enough in terms of how to pull different levers and where the pain points were, where Johnson's, I'll give him some credit.
He's a wild card.
He probably knows it, but he's figuring it out for the first time.
Yeah. And he definitely had some true beliefs,
Yeah.
For financial markets, shutdowns are not that particularly scary. That's usually the case, right? They're assumed to be relatively quick. You backfill a lot of the, spending that you had foregone because everybody gets made whole for the most part, not contractors, but you end up with you end up with a little bit of a divot and then a little bit of a speed bump, and you kind of, you know, smooth them out. And it doesn't have that existential, you know, disaster movie quality the debt ceiling has.
Yes.
It can't necessarily, like, you know, it doesn't default on the obligations of the government. And so it tends to be something that markets kind of, you know, look past. And even the lengthiest one, which I believe was in 2019, was, you know, it was about a month. And everybody gets tired of it, and the optics are terrible. And so, you know, these things end up usually getting solved, you know, relatively rapidly. But yeah, again, unprecedented times on Capitol Hill, no question about it. And going into an election season that is, you know, heating up with heating up pretty quickly, and is going to be, you know, I think, to say the least, not the nation's finest hour.
No, I mean, that's the other thing of January. We enter into January, February. Well, even though we may know what the race looks like now, we'll get into the real primary season, and we'll start to get official on likely Biden and Trump, and a general election kicking off pretty quickly after that.
And that's another aspect for the Fed that's tough. Like, it couldn't be a worse year to have a presidential election, where they have, you know, very, very difficult choices to make. And, you know, in a presidential election, the Fed does not want to be front and center. But which may make them, you know, stay higher for longer than they might have done in previous years.
Yeah. And especially with these candidates, I mean, they're going to be front and center, whether they like it or not. And I know Powell will hate that, but especially Trump, we've seen what he's done in the past. So,
well, that'll be interesting. And the thing about Trump is, you know, he's not really on social media, right? So we don't hear much about Trump. So we're not totally exactly sure, you know, what to say once he's the candidate and is, you know, making speeches and debating and things like that. So that'll be very interesting, especially you have to imagine the Fed will come up, and we know.
I mean, to your point, that's the wild card in 24. I mean, he's had a strategy of just sit back, like his numbers are so rock solid, he doesn't have to even participate in this campaign right now. But come, you know, probably end of first quarter, you know, he'll start getting very vocal as he moves to a general election, and it's just him versus Biden, and he can be on TV every day just countering the president. And yes, I think that means Powell and others will get into his crosshairs.
He's already said in an interview recently that interest rates are too high. I think the quote was, you know, people can't buy a house, they can't do anything. And we've seen this movie before. He's a very, you know, he's a debt guy. He's a stimulus guy, right? This guy is not a fiscal rectitude candidate. And so it'll be interesting that, you know, that formulation was kind of, you know, appropriate for the 2017 sort of stagflation dynamic. But if, you know, you try to prick now with the macro backdrop we have, you know, it could be gasoline on the fire.
Yeah, totally. Well, guys, what else did we miss from this week, or what are we looking forward to next week?
Boy, next week is a little quiet. It's not the same kind of gauntlet of, you know, monetary policy and data, huge consequential data numbers and, you know, big corporate bellwethers reporting. It's like kind of the end of earnings season. We get some like U.S. trade numbers. I think Powell's going to be on Fed Chair Powell's going to be on some sort of panel discussion where he'll probably just repeat what he said in the post FOMC presser this week. So yeah, maybe kind of a nice week to
take a break and catch our breath.
Yeah, that's right. Catch your breath. Yeah.
And then we have Veterans Day. So Friday's a holiday.
Nice. We could use it.
Yeah.
Great. Well, guys, thanks for having me back on. Appreciate jumping in. Hopefully I did all right for Alon. And hopefully we'll be back soon as well.
Yes, indeed. Thanks, Brian.
Thank you, guys. And to all our listeners on the Macrocast, thanks for tuning into another episode. We'll be back next week. Alon will be back in the host seat. But for now, you can follow us on X or Twitter at PentaGRP. You can follow Market Policy Partners, and we'll be back next week.